Hello, everybody out there in podcast universe. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am your host, CEO of Literal Humans, Paul David, and I'm joined today by Amanda Bickerstaff, founder and CEO of AI for Education. Welcome to the pod, Amanda.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Today, we're going to talk about empowering educators through AI. And by way of introduction, Amanda is the founder and CEO, as I said, of AI for Education. Amanda is a former high school biology teacher and ed tech executive with over 20 years of experience in the education sector. Shout out to former educators. I used to be a middle school teacher as well, Amanda. So, yeah.
Amazing.
Where did you teach, by the way?
I taught high school biology in the Bronx, so a small school in Taft High School, which is where the book The Blackboard Jungle, which was very like this seminal book about poverty and the complexity of teaching, was actually written about. So small school, highly complex environment, still the most complicated, like most, you know, difficult thing I've ever done is still teaching at that school.
Yeah, I resonate with that a lot. I say, like, you know, I used to teach in Southwest Philly. So, like, anything you throw at me, like, I'm good. I'll figure it out. So, appreciate that. And thank you for your service. So, at AI for Education, she leads efforts to empower educators and academic institutions through responsible AI adoption and training. Very hot topic. The company has been growing rapidly since its founding in April 2023, now partnering with more than 150 academic institutions across K-12 and higher education, including some of the largest school districts in the U.S. Amanda is a frequent speaker and consultant in the field, having been featured on BBC News, CBS Morning News, discussing the role of AI in education. Well, welcome to the pod. How did we do?
Yeah, good. I mean, I think that both the BBC and the Morning News were debates about AI in education, where the first one I did not know was a debate till I showed up at 7:30 in the morning for my first ever live studio interview. And then they were like, fight. But we did not fight. We actually were very pleasant. But yeah, it was great. Thank you for the introduction and excited to be here.
And why do I have a feeling you were very ready for that debate, regardless of not getting any notice?
It is such a funny thing because, you know, we take a very balanced approach, but I think that people see the name AI for Education and think, oh my gosh, Amanda must be the most pro AI person for schools. And I'd actually say that we're probably like more on the like being very pragmatic, practical side. And so I think that when I debate, like it's not that hard to do because I can argue both parts and we do argue both points. So it's kind of hard to nail me down into like a position of pro or con. It really needs to be like, this is a time for nuance. This is a time for subtlety, which sounds so weird considering how much hype and how loud it is. But for us, it was just really fascinating. I do have to say it was very funny because, you know, I was in the chair and they're like, yeah, James Taylor is going to debate you on AI. And I'm like, I love James Taylor. It was not that James Taylor. It was like a very tall British professor who has banned, he's a philosophy professor. He'd actually banned AI in his classroom. And so it was a very surreal thing, but I thought it was pretty good. I did think it was really funny how the two anchors were like, you know, this is going to be a big, you know, knockout. And then we're like, just really nice to each other.
So that's how they get their ratings, though. Yeah, that's how they get their ratings. Well, let's paint the big picture for our audience there. You know, we're seeing lots of schools taking very different approaches to AI and tech as a whole. We actually had a British headmaster who, you know, banned mobile devices, you know, in his school. We had a chat with him on the pod. As I said, some of them are restricting access fully, and some of them are embracing new and upcoming tech, you know, more completely. Talk us through how you see this divide in education, you know, through 2025 and beyond. How has the landscape evolved since the launch of tools like ChatGPT and Claude?
Well, I think that it's a really interesting and potentially unfortunate timing coming off the back of COVID, where I think that a couple of things. Well, I think that there's a couple of things. One is that we've had a decade of smart devices and internet capability for our young people. And so I think we're coming off of like this really, really radical change into how kids learn, communicate, have social interactions, even self-perceptions have changed. Then you have COVID, where everyone had to get online at the same time. And what that did is it exposed just how insufficient education technology or even like meeting technology was to replace the deep learning that we need to happen. You've seen that. I mean, if you experienced it, I was running an education technology company in Melbourne, Australia, the most locked down city in the world, where, you know, the majority of our schools are in Victoria, where we're out of school for almost a full year and a half because of the really, really difficult lockdowns that happen. And so what we have is like, you have this like 10 years of devices, 2+ years of COVID with online learning really exposing just all the cracks. And then almost immediately, right? Like we're talking like 1.5 years later, you have ChatGPT released into the world as an experiment. And that's the thing. It was released as an experiment with no guardrails, no understanding. And what's happened is no matter what happens about what you talk about is that the, you know, one of the largest users of generative AI, two largest users are going to be coders, software engineers, and students. So what we have here is like this massive disruption that's come. And we like to liken generative AI to, it's more similar to the internet and electricity than it is to an application or device. And so like the idea that you can ban electricity and the internet is like going to be quite difficult. And as generative AI becomes more ubiquitous and proliferates within all of our devices and all of our ed tech and all of our, you know, social tech, et cetera, it really becomes this piece where like the idea that you can somehow like this, that the fact that you're you know, by having no devices that you can ban generative AI, I don't think that's really a long-term solution. And when I say long-term, I think we have to think about the quantum of time right now is not decades, but years. So I don't think, if you're talking about a long-term solution for ChatGPT or generative AI, it's like 5 years. And so I don't think that we really have that opportunity to like ban, because it's going to be such a huge part of our lives, whether the kids have a device at school or at home.
Yeah. We'd love to hear from you because you're kind of at the heart of this debate. What's like a misconception or two that you find to be, you know, so prevalent, you know, about AI and education that you encounter in your work with schools?
Man, there's a lot. One is that academic integrity, that's the only risk to kids is academic integrity violations and cognitive offload. That is real, but there are much like a lot of other big issues around artificial companionship. 3 of the top 10 visited generative AI sites are social, emotional, character AI, and 2 others that I won't name because they have some funny names. But AI companionship is on the rise, especially for young people. You've got deepfakes. I'm now started asking in mixed groups, meaning like districts, who has had a deepfake issue. And now at least one hand is going up. Non-consensual nudes, deepfake nudes that are happening. So I would say that this idea of like academic integrity being the only risk to young people and cognitive offload is really can be quite damaging. There's a lot of like really potentially enormous other issues around bias and misinformation. I think the second thing that's a big misconception is that everyone's all in. I find it very interesting to see like that there's this kind of rhetoric online that like everyone believes is going to like transform education. And I think it's a lot more complex than that. And I think that this idea that it's a savior or this one-stop shop just hasn't been the case in what we've seen. I think there's a lot more fear and uncertainty than there is like overwhelming embracing of these tools to the point of the school leader you had. And then I think the third thing that is a pretty significant misconception is that these tools are at all fit for purpose for schools, that like that because kids use it, somehow they're going to work. And so, for example, like these tools are at the earliest stage and they're really unreliable and they make a lot of mistakes. And so I think that like it really isn't that good yet. And so even like the young people using these tools are probably using them in the worst possible way, in the most superficial, unsafe way possible. And like I think that that itself, because we have this idea that digital native means digital literate or that AI native will mean AI literate, and we just know that's not the case. And so I think that that kind of lack of fit for purposeness, the lack of reliability means that whoever is using it, it's probably not using it in a very good way. And that doesn't even mean that like they're using it in an unsafe and unethical way, but I bet that the stuff that they're getting for the most part is just not that quality. Because research shows that if you don't have AI literacy, it doesn't matter how good the model you're using or chatbot you're using is. It's actually users that make the biggest difference in terms of the quality of the output. So I think those are probably the 3 biggest misconceptions we see.
Yeah, that's a great segue. I mean, the digging into what your team does, and tell us a bit more if you can about how you structure your AI literacy training and you know, the services that you offer, which have proven the most impactful, and also paint a picture about how your training differs from others in the space.
Well, I think for us, we are different. I think that like our website will be 2 years old on April 17th. So this is this week, which was created by me. I never created a website before, and I built a prompt library. And that prompt library, if you've never used ChatGPT or if you have, when you interact with generative AI, you're actually coding with language. So we could either through talking or typing, and that's called prompting. It is an actual technical, you know, approach to this. It's still pretty, we don't know exactly what makes the most, but there's some really nice research-backed approaches that actually make a difference. So this prompt library forces you into, someone called it the UK, Olangi's simple recipes for prompting, meaning like you just cut and paste, puts you into a format and you get these great outputs. And so for us, that's always been the anchor. It's always been really, really practical. And so from the very beginning, our flagship PD has really, I would say, this is why people I think get very surprised. You're like, you must be updating your PD every day because of how quickly generative AI is moving. But the thing is, like, we haven't. Because good Gen AI literacy, the models themselves are improving and there's more multimodality and things are getting more complex, but not the underpinning technology underneath it. So it allows us to do a lot more. So what we do is we anchor. So our flagship is usually 90 minutes to half day. It's 90 minutes online, and we give a very good line online, virtual, which is great because people do not like it right now because of post-COVID fatigue, or half day in person. And what we do is we start, first of all, like, you cannot start with any expectation that people know what generative AI is and what AI has been. And so I know that sounds crazy because it's 2.5 years in, but there are still people that generally do not understand that AI has been around us for decades. The first chatbot was in the 60s, Eliza. It's been around for a ton of time. But this moment in time is that we tell them we're not here for an AI training. We're here for a generative AI training. And so we have to understand that. And then what we do is we have a myths and facts game. So this is kind of where we load the like direct instruction, but in like a more kind of like, you know, thoughtful and like intentional way around key misconceptions and concerns. So no one gets out of the first 30 to 35 minutes without having all those misconceptions slayed, having all those fears talked to, and understanding that generative AI is not just here to stay, but is going to improve, like all technology will improve. And then we go into prompting. And what I found to be the most impactful, Paul, I was calling you David. It's hard to have two first names.
I get it all the time.
But what we find to be most impactful is what we do is we do, first we show the limitations. We show ChatGPT not being able to count, or, you know, not knowing its own knowledge cutoff, but then also showing how creative it is. Then we work on a mindset piece of like the mindsets of good Gen AI use. And then people try, but this is the big part. You know what's crazy is that our biggest way to make impact is to do a think aloud, where we take a traditional like rubric and then we blow it up. We make it funny and we add slang. We anticipate student issues. We do games or like on Claude. Or what it does, it completely takes people from where they were when they walked in, whether that's, you know, thinking they understand or not. And then we move them to this like moment of like creativity and possibility. And so for us, that has worked. I mean, it is wild because you know how difficult teachers are. We were both teachers. Yeah. I would have been, and I was, the teacher that was like so not into PD. Like I just was like, I found it so difficult to sit in there. I was so overloaded. And if the PD did not make sense to me, then why am I there?
Yeah.
We have not had a hard room once.
Really?
We've had everything from the smallest districts, the most rural, to the largest districts in the country, to kids, to teachers, to 30-year-old veterans, to higher education. And it's worked every time.
That's great. I mean,
it's wild. But yeah, but it just like matters today. Like I think there's got to be a pedagogical frame to generate literacy, and I think we luckily have nailed it.
Yeah. So that point, like, what have you observed as sort of the most important skills educators need to develop to use AI effectively and responsibly in their classrooms?
So I think the first thing is transparency. We really, 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 really want teachers and leaders to be transparent about their own use and take it out of the shadows, because if they're more transparent, then kids will ask for permission instead of hiding their use or avoiding it. I think that those mindsets of like, it's got to be conversational. Like you can't stop after the first prompt. If it doesn't work the first time, it's either a technical glitch because it's not very good yet, or it's because you didn't ask it a good question, or you didn't give enough feedback. And so getting people in the mindset of like it being conversational, we joke that like two things we say is, one is lean into what makes you an expert in education, your questioning technique, your feedback, your ability to evaluate, to be creative and flexible is what you need to be a good user of a generative AI chatbot. But then secondly is like, we need to go back to when we were baby teachers. Like we were like little baby teachers, and like we had all of the will, like all of the will, right? But we had like very little skill. But we were like willing. I remember my first day of teaching, Paul, taught in the Bronx. I did not have a classroom. So I had my little cart and I had spent the weekend building using cabbage to make red dye indicator for pH scales. And then I did that in front of the kids with my little cart. I don't think anybody cared, unfortunately. But also I was having to pour out the like stuff into like, we didn't even have a sink. It was just like the fountain outside, which let's not even talk about that. But I had all of that creativity, all that will, that it gets beaten out of us a bit because of all the administrative pieces, that like getting back to that core of like, oh my God, you mean I could do all of these amazing things? It does mean I have to take some time and build some efficacy. Like that's where the light bulbs go off. That's where people are like, oh my God, you mean I can have bespoke images for my kids learning the ABCs, or I can start to like make it funny when I know that I'm more terse, or I've never been able to reach those students that are from Cambodia or from Laos or from the Hmong, like because now I can have more ability to do that through the translation opportunities, the voice to text, et cetera. That is the, like, that's the special sauce. And like, you can't start there because it's not intuitive. Mm-hmm. You can't just start with the crazy. You have to really build the foundations because this technology works like no technology that's ever come before it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you started to allude towards this, but like, give me like a story that like really sticks in your mind about, you know, a transformation that you saw when an educator kind of unlocked and they became AI literate. Like, what did you observe? What did you see?
You know what? It's so great. There's so many. I think that like, you know, I think, what are the ones? I think that one of my favorites, this is going to sound silly, but we were in a relatively conservative independent school in the South. Because what I love about this is we've worked with every type of school now. And you had this huge, you know, huge auditorium, bad, you know, like the AV was terrible, but people were into it. And like, but you could tell that like the large language model chatbots weren't quite for everyone. Some of the older, like, you know, the veteran teachers were kind of unsure. But then I showed them Image Generation as like a fun thing. And one of the teachers who had been really on the fence had such a good time. She like got up, she went to her administration and said, oh my God, look what I can do. And so this is why I say, like, it's not, large language models won't be for everyone, the chatbots, but there's going to be that. I think that two other really good examples where sometimes that people really think they know, and I've had a couple people that like really try, and then they're like, it's just not that good. And then we unlock that piece with the prompt library and the techniques where they're like, I cannot believe I've been beating my head against a wall for a year and a half. And I could have just slightly framed it. So that's a really great one. That happened just recently in a district in New York. And then I think the third one is probably one of my favorites, where I think that paraprofessionals or teacher's aides, whatever we call it, wherever we are, often get a short stick, right? They really are just there and they either do nothing or everything, and like they have very little prep time. And so what happened is there was a teacher and a TA that sat next to each other. They worked together. They were vibing like crazy. They were like off in a shot. And we don't mind when people go on rabbit holes if they stop listening a bit to do. But they had come up with this beautiful strategy of how they were going to take the next week's lessons. And the paraprofessional had a full support for the next week of what she was expected to do, techniques, strategy, plan. And they, just in like 10 minutes, they had already started this. And I think that that was just so powerful because it was so agentic to both of them. And you know that if there's better preparation for a TA or teacher's aide and a teacher, you know who benefits? The kids. Mm-hmm. The kids that need it most. So I think that those three, like, they're kind of the gamut, right? Everything from veteran to like, I think I know, but it doesn't work, to those like opportunities that are really never impossible for.
Yeah, I love that you brought in paraprofessionals too, because they're truly like some of the unsung heroes in schools and just like backing teachers up. And yeah, I think that's those are great examples. Thank you for sharing. I want to push us to talk a little bit about your organization and your growth.
Sure.
Like you've made this big goal, you know, this big hairy audacious goal, as we say, BHAG, of supporting a million educators. And would love to hear about your roadmap for that. You know, how does this tie into your overall growth and marketing strategy? And, you know, yeah, we'd just love to get a sense of like any challenges you face in getting educational institutions to invest in AI training and literacy.
You know, the cool thing is that we're very lucky because we have both our services side of the business to get that goal, but also we had over 1 million visits to our website last year from 130 countries. And so our free course has already reached over 25,000 people internationally. We have done work with, we're approaching 200 partners. Even the 150 is not accurate anymore. There are weeks where we actually train 4,000 to 5,000 people. And so it's been great. And I think that it is audacious, but I think it is necessary. I think that AI literacy, generative AI literacy specifically, has not been really considered a need yet. And we believe very strongly that it has to be, not to preclude other things. But I do think that like AI literacy is like a great way to teach digital media literacy, information literacy. It's kind of a backdoor Trojan horse into all of those. Because it's more engaging and it's also more broken. So you can show all those cracks pretty easily. The way that we do, so first of all, like it's really quite funny because we talk about like your founder journey or how you do this. If there's anybody on here that like is thinking about it, I have a couple of tips. Number one is that when I started AI for Education, I was building a transformer model with a partner for well-being, but I had just started posting LinkedIn again for the first time in a year. And I was just seeing that people were really struggling knowing what to do. And all the rhetoric online was either this is going to kill us, education is toast and done and kids will never learn again, or it is the best thing in the world, get on the bus or get run over. And no one was playing this middle role in very pragmatic places. So when I did that, it became very clear they need to be helped. And that's why I built the prompt library and the website. But then my co-founder, Dan, I've known for almost a decade. He's, you know, marketing expert and whiz. We were at his kitchen table because I was like, these two options, right? And he was like, I like both of them, but you'll never make any money with AI for Education. And I was like, okay. And then by the time it got to like Memorial Day, right before that, my co-founder was like, you can't do both. You cannot do this transform. You can't build this company over here and the other one because they're too much time and too different. And so it was quite funny because I still remember that moment with Dan. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go for AI for Education is going to be the thing. And we're going to give everything for free. And so we'd start with the prompt library. We then did 25 webinars in 26 weeks from June to the end of the year, all free. 25,000 people joined. First, we had 12 people on our mailing list for the first webinar, and we had about 30,000 by the end of the year. And we had made the free courses out in August of 2023. We have a free women's group in AI Education, August 2023. And so our entire revenue the first year was like 40K, like from June to, like, it was not much. But what happened is that, like, because of this like free stuff and it was so impactful is that we keep being brought in, Paul, after people have used our stuff for a year, 2.5 years to now 2 years. So they still want to work with us, even though everything is free, because they believe that we are the group that can make, like, to be the lever, the wedge, to bring in AI literacy and to show this, to create this galvanizing action that big change has to happen. So I think that that's been really great. We grew a ton last year. We are growing a ton this year. We're going to be at our revenue target from last year by the end of this month. Things are going great. But I do think that if you talk about the risk is that we have a lot of volatility where budgets are being impacted, even if directly or indirectly. And so I think that AI literacy being able to like have the same momentum right now, I think that that's probably our biggest concern.
Yeah. Do you feel like I'm curious about this, the spectrum that we see. So like it feels like folks are at different points in the spectrum from AI enthusiasm to AI anxiety. So I'd love to hear, you know, like, are you using your firsthand experience as a classroom teacher to help you navigate that and sort of meet people where they are? How are you addressing like what feels like a huge burden of like customer client education just to get folks to, you know, engage with your product and your service?
Well, I think that's what everything we do is like that. I think that we have a virtual train the trainer, Gen AI literacy train the trainer, that's in its second cohort. We'll have our third cohort starting in May. So almost 500 people internationally have taken it already and just since January. And one of my favorite parts of the so it's a course and then 4 live sessions is we have an entire couple lessons on psychological safety. And all of that does is say, like, how do you create a space where people are able to listen? And this is so noisy and so scary for so many reasons, is that so much of what we do, whether it's in a call with someone that comes to us, a conference, a session with teachers or leaders or students, is just to acknowledge that this is a lot going on and that this is an opportunity, that while we are not going to espouse any technical tool, we're not going to sell you anything, we are asking you to learn, because if you learn, with AI literacy being the number one rising skill on LinkedIn, for example, in the last month, it's just going to help prepare you for a changing world, but also your students. But to do that, what we do, or at least what I do, this is my style. I'm two people. I love telling a bad joke and I love telling a good research fact and like an evidence-based fact. And that's my style. But everyone on my team has a style and our former educators, they're able to meet people where they are. And we do not expect anyone to come out of that room saying, I love it. But what we want you to do is I learned and I am open to learning more is our goal. And I think because that's our goal, it allows us to really give space to people wherever they are. So that means you're novice, you're pessimist, you're optimist, anyone in between will get something out of this, because all we're trying to do is move you from point A to point B. And that point B, though, isn't the same for everyone. This is really a zone of proximal development, really. Like, if you consider it, like, wherever someone's ready to go, we're going to bring you to that next step. And I feel very confident that we're able to do that, because we do not come in with this, like, ivory tower or this, like, expectation. Because that would just – I think that's such a disservice. Like, people need to have time to think about this, to understand it, to even come to grips with the fact that education has to change.
Yeah. Yeah, I think first of all, I love that you mentioned zone of proximal development, because it's probably one of the education concepts that I use the most, like, in sort of my, you know, as a leader, as someone who sort of has to build and support teams and really encourage individuals, and obviously growth mindset. Those are for you the favorites, the best hits, I guess. Well, want to ask you some, you know, like, just a quick follow up about the moment. Was there a moment when you sort of were like, aha, AI literacy is the thing? Or was it a series of small moments that kind of built up over time?
Do you mean for starting the company, or do you mean for just in general?
For starting the company.
I think the moment was, like, you know, in Australia when I was locked in the country. By the way, thank you, Australia, for, like, locking me in Melbourne for 2 years. But I love Australia, but not that part. I ended up being able to be really good at webinar facilitation, just because it was, like, nothing I'd really done. By the way, I had never done a keynote when I started AI for Education. I was never the PL person. I was always the one building it. I wasn't the one doing it. So, but I gave a good webinar. So The first one wasn't even a webinar. It was a LinkedIn chat with Mike Yates, my buddy, and like 200 people came. And I was like, and they came live, and they came, and it was great. So we now had 200 people on our mailing list. But then we did our first webinar with John Nash, who I met in person for the first time this weekend at the AI show. And it was on design thinking AI, like, how do you think about this? And we had like 1,000 people. And it just, at that moment, I mean, it is wild to be able to, as a baby company with nothing, no background, nothing, to be able to suddenly meet the needs of so many people so quickly. And I think that that was the moment. I also just think that, like, I think there are moments of crystallization. When I used ChatGPT for the first time, I did not use Playground. I did not use ChatGPT 2. And I was not paying attention to artificial intelligence, even when I was building, Pivot, technical platform, because we cannot afford machine learning. So the first time I used ChatGPT, it was like this moment of crystallization of, like, oh my gosh, this could be the transformational technology in ed tech if we do this the right way. But also, I just knew immediately that no one would figure this out, really. Mm. That schools are too complicated, and it was too non-intuitive and too different than the traditional way of using technology, that people are going to need help. And that's really it. I don't think I ever thought anything different, if that makes sense. I never thought when I started posting in the website was going to be anything other than responsible use with guidelines and policy development, which we do. But really, it was going to be about training people to know what this was and wasn't. And that was it. Yeah. I think that was always the plan. And thank goodness it worked, Paul, because we were very committed to this. We didn't take salaries for a year. Like, we, we really committed to this completely. And now we have, like, 5 full-time staff, and we're hiring 2 more. We have, like, 6 contractors. Like, how freaking cool is it to have, like, a little business? Like, I mean, I will say, you need an operations person and a BD person when you get as big as us. And so I don't have any of those yet, but we are hiring now. But otherwise, I mean, it's such a gift. It's wild how great it's been.
I mean, I so resonate with that on so many levels. First of all, the operations person, that was my biggest learning in the last year. Just yes to that. Secondly, there have been quarters where I just didn't take pay. So, like, I feel that, like, that pain that you're like, I'm so committed to this mission that I'm willing to sacrifice my family, my relationship, my partner, like, all that stuff. You know what I mean? And then also, I love the piece where you've taken this, like, grain from, like, hey, I understand this sector really well. And I know I can predict that this is going to be difficult for them. So I'm going to jump into that problem. And, like, living in that question, I think, is so powerful. It's sort of the reason I started LH is, like, I know that charities and tech for good, I know they really deserve great growth strategy and marketing, and they don't always get it for a lot of reasons. And so that was, like, the grain of, like, oh, I know this because I've been there. I've been the ED. I've been the board member who didn't have a great growth strategy. And now, we try to deliver it. So, yeah.
So there's product market fit, right? But there's founder market and founder problem fit that is not talked about very often.
I like that.
And this is my advice to anybody that's thinking about starting something, is that do the things you are best at first. And that's why we did the webinars, is I just am good at a webinar, and that was just where I threw it. But also, like, it is wild right now that people like just do less better. Mm-hmm. You don't have to do everything perfectly, but pick a problem that is so suited to you that you know it's your flow state, because that makes the hard part easier. Because you're going to be able to hire if you are successful, you're going to be able to hire in for the places that you're not great at, right? But that core of what makes you perfect for that problem, that market, is going to just be the biggest boon you're ever going to have. Because then, you know, locus of control is so important for founders.
Yeah.
And to be able to control what works and doesn't work will give you that you talk about psychological safety. They'll give you the psychological safety that you know that you can keep going, and the complexity that will keep coming up. You can do the hard part. And I think that is what I found, is that, you know, why we have been the way we have is we just leaned into what makes us special, what makes educators special. And we're not trying to be a tech company. We're not trying to sell other people's products. What we're trying to do is just like use our care and want for impact in a way that people understand and find value in.
Yeah. And it's so easy to get distracted. You know what I mean? It's so easy to chase the shiny thing, or to chase funding, or to, you know, chase a client that you probably shouldn't be working with. So yeah, I really appreciate the rigor of just staying focused and kind of, you know, sticking to what you're good at. I love that founder market fit piece too. I'm going to start using that. It's really good. I want to push us into the quick fire questions. This is the chance where our audience gets to know you. They're a bit more fun. First thing that comes to mind, try to keep it, you know, short and snappy. I'll give you a little bit of time to, you know, give me your why for each. But they're just kind of, fun, silly questions. First question, if you could found another startup, another organization, what would it be and why?
Something in disaster relief. I do a lot of disaster relief in my personal life. I started a relief organization after Hurricane Sandy in New York. And then I do a lot of, like, I was in Greece during the refugee crisis. And then also do hurricane relief. So I think it would be something around that. Maybe it would just honestly maybe be a food truck.
Ooh,
where I just go to places in need and feed them, because that's really my bag.
Yeah, I love that. There's a fire station here in London, and it says on the front of it, love is the running towards. And yes. I love it. Like, you think about your first responders or, you know, disaster relief people. These people are running into danger, and it's just so, yeah. So
my impressive. Mom was so glad I was locked in Australia during COVID and Black Lives Matter, because she was like, she's like, at least you're very far away, but at least you cannot run into danger. So
yeah,
she was absolutely very happy.
What tech invention makes you the most excited?
I think one of the things that right now makes me excited is vertical AI being used to help diagnose and support medical issues. I think that being able to like really find the core quickly of what's wrong with someone, I think it's going to be, to me, is the thing that I'm probably most excited about right now.
Yeah, it's really exciting. The possibilities that keep coming out are amazing. And then flip side of that, what tech invention makes you the most concerned?
The move towards superintelligence or AGI at all costs. So big tech throwing billions of dollars and energy consumption at building superintelligence with no real plan for what happens if that's possible, but also like the amount of climate impact on the way to that. I think that's my biggest concern.
Yeah. I was trying to explain to some friends, like the amount of energy that gets used when you put in a request, you know, to like, it's just like, it's mind blowing.
Well, I mean, this is a misconception.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
The individual consumer use of most products, you almost think of it as time to task and time and cost. So if you're using a reasoning model that still has a high environmental cost, but your general queries are very low.
Okay.
The vast majority of the climate impact is that there are two levels. There's the attention level, which is how you use it, mm-hmm. and the training level, which is how the models are trained. The vast, vast majority of the climate impact is the training of the model. So like Llama 2, $170 million. That is where that race to the top or the bottom, whatever it will be, is where most of the climate impact is. But the individual user, I think you can feel relatively confident now, unless you are doing 100 deep research queries, is your environmental impact is much lower than when it was at the beginning of ChatGPT.
I love that. Thank you for educating me on that. And that those are like the little nuggets.
It's the most, this is what I said, nuance is hard, but this is like a time for nuance.
And these misconceptions too. Like that's the way I bring folks like yourself onto the pod, because this like changes our thinking about these things, so and informs us. So thank you for that. Who's a literal human who's been integral to your career journey that you want to shout out?
It's been literal. I think my parents. It's so weird. Like, I don't know. I didn't have a lot of, I was always weird. I was always a strange human. So like it made like working for other people always like, you know, a funny, weird thing. I do think that my parents, they literally joined LinkedIn to like my posts. And my mom, her name is Helene Bickerstaff. It is lowercase with no image for a profile. And every once in a while, people are like, is that your mom commenting on your, and I'm like, yeah, that's definitely my mom. So I would say my parents.
Shout out Helene. Nice.
Who still, I was like, mom, we really, please just put a picture.
Yeah, something.
It can still be lowercase, but just put a picture.
Can you just be normal on the social media?
It's just always funny when people are like, oh my God, that's your mom. Like, yeah, 1,000%.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And then what's an inspirational quote that stuck with you during your journey in AI and tech?
Gosh, I'm not a quote person. I remember most things, but I don't remember quotes. I don't know.
A resource or a book or a saying.
Ethan Mollick would definitely be the person that... He is so good about research and sharing research and trying things out. So he's a business professor at Wharton Business Education, and he just nails the zeitgeist, what's happening. I tend to agree with him. We tend to come to the same point from different angles, but I also love some research, and he is very, very good about both creating new research on the topic and also sharing it. Ethan Mollick, Substack, and on LinkedIn.
Nice. We'll check him out. Thank you for that resource. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. I think, you know, a big part of this is highlighting how AI isn't replacing educators, but it's a tool to empower them with new tools and kind of, you know, enhance teaching and learning if used thoughtfully. Before you go, are there any closing thoughts about the future of AI in education that you want to share with our listeners as we close out here?
I think we tell people all the time that you're not too late to get started wherever you are in this journey. But I've started to say, though, that if you wait until 2027 or 20, like, so you're going to go, you're going to miss next year to 25 to 26 school year. If you start in the 26 school year to 27, I think you're going to start being too late. I think that the quantum change, the proliferation and ubiquity of the tools, the capabilities and the impact on young people will be so strong by then that not having a plan in place for AI literacy for kids, for kids, 2026 next year should be the year of AI literacy for kids, which means you have to start with your teachers. So start that now. And then having some set of guidelines for responsible use, like that needs to be put in place for after like the 2026, 2027 school year. So please, it doesn't have to be with us. We have so many free resources. We have guidance development. We have free courses. We have everything. But like that work needs to start in the next school year. It just needs to.
Yeah, I love that as a mission, like make that the year of AI literacy and like the, you know, the grounding and purpose of like, this is for the kids, like they need to learn this. We need to do this for them because this is the world they're growing into. So really appreciate that. Where can folks find out more about the great work that you're doing in AI for Education?
So AIforeducation.io, because .com wasn't available when I built the website. We post on LinkedIn 4 days a week usually, which is like another job, but we share a lot of resources there. We have a newsletter. Our free webinars are pretty much every other week. The next one coming up is a new resource that's focused on math education and AI. Spoiler alert, Gen AI is very bad at doing math. So like be very careful, but that's the best way. And if we do virtual sessions and workshops as well, but you know, we, like I said, the top of this, like most of what we do is free, so please use us as a resource, and you can find that on our website.
Amazing. Well, thank you. I know you're having a really busy time right now. You're, you know, on your mission to reach a million educators and to reach the students that they serve. So thank you for taking it. It's been a great conversation on Tech Can't Save Us podcast with Amanda Bickerstaff, the founder and CEO of AI for Education. Thanks so much, Amanda.
Thanks, Paul. I hope everyone has a great day.
Thank you. For our listeners, please make sure to leave a review, give us a 5-star rating so we can keep bringing on amazing guests like Amanda to the pod. Bye, everybody.